Catholic Answers Live. My name is Christopher Check. I am president of Catholic Answers, sitting in for your usual host, Cy Kellett, who was unable to make it in today, and our intrepid producer, Darren Delosier, said, Chris, will you host the show? And I said, I have a ton of work to do, but I would rather host the show. So here I am. And coming up in our second hour, first, I should say, the number to get on the show today, 888-318-7884. 888-31-TRUTH to ask your question. Coming up in the second hour today, Trent Horn with what is it about Catholic teaching you don't like? And in the first hour, Trent Horn with what is it about Catholic teaching you don't like? Am I saying the name of the title of the show correctly here, Trent?
I'm going to call that a dynamic translation of the show's original text.
Oh, okay, sure.
Of the original text as it was dictated. I think it's why
that kind of dynamic translation is very popular now.
In some cases, yes. I think why do you reject Catholic morality? But I think we did change that because not everyone rejects all of. I'd be hard pressed to find any individual who rejects every single moral teaching of the Catholic faith.
Say, for example, defrauding laborers of their wages. Now, if you have a problem with that particular moral teaching, you're welcome to call in and Trent can help explain that. But I'm guessing we're not going to get, hey, you know what? I want to defraud my workers of their wages.
Well, I don't recommend doing it. The letter of James says it's the sin that cries out to heaven.
It does, for vengeance.
For vengeance indeed to not pay the laborers what they're worth. So lots of issues, both on social issues, life issues, issues related to human sexuality. So,
reproduction.
And there's a lot of different kinds of teachings, and we're happy to address and just see what you think about them, why you don't accept those teachings, maybe have a dialogue about it.
888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. Trent, I went home for lunch, and my son Nathaniel, who's home on summer vacation, his summer vacation started 3 months ago or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, right. But anyway, so I said, oh, I'm hosting the show today. He says, who's the guest? And I said, Trent Horn. And he said, are you going to talk about Star Wars?
It's a possibility. Okay. It could always come up in an analogy, or it could come up in friendly, playful banter. I find sometimes, Chris, when you talk about particular moral issues, it can be helpful to talk about other fictional scenarios and situations like that to try to give us a little bit of a thought experiment. For example, when you think about the church's teaching on suicide, I got an email about this a few days ago dealing with, you know, is suicide wrong? Is assisted suicide wrong? And the person who emailed me asked about the scene from Last of the Mohicans. I forget the character. Did you ever see the film?
The one with Daniel Day-Lewis?
Yeah, yeah.
And Madeline Stowe, or who's the actress?
I do not remember. It's been forever since I've seen Last of the Mohicans. There's that
I want to say cinematically, it is a very stirring picture,
yeah.
But it does an injustice to the James Fenimore Cooper books.
Right.
Because I think that Natty Bumppo, the Natty Bumppo character, mm-hmm. Really is almost kind of a celibate character.
Right.
And he's not at all in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
So, well, the question was, there's a scene, I think it's Daniel Day-Lewis, I can't remember the characters involved, where one character has been captured by the indigenous peoples and is going to be executed on a pyre, I believe.
The Iroquois, I guess that is.
Yeah. So they're...
Or Mohawks.
Yeah, they've taken this gentleman as a prisoner of war and they're executing him by immolation. So they're setting him on fire. And I think it's Daniel Day-Lewis's character or another character sees him in the scope of his rifle and shoots him to put him out of his misery.
Right.
And so the question I received was, is it wrong to do this?
Right.
And so what the person said to me is, I don't think this is assisted suicide, but is it? Can we justify this? And then what about other parallel cases where people take actions that seem to result in their death but don't seem like suicide, like somebody jumping out of the World Trade Center when it's collapsing or on fire?
Right.
And so the point of my reply was, well, in the case from Last of the Mohicans, that seems clear to me it's an example of assisted suicide, that the point here is to end someone's life as quickly as possible in order to reduce the suffering that they are undergoing. And so I cautioned this gentleman, said that we have to be careful about our intuitions and feelings in these matters, because if you say that that circumstance is okay, then wouldn't it be justified for a doctor to prescribe a terminally ill patient with stage 4 bone cancer a poison or a drug they take to end their own life, they're also undergoing pain. More, the person dying of a very painful cancer may undergo more pain in a total sense than that character in Last of the Mohicans, who will be immolated for a few minutes. What about someone who's going to be suffering from cancer for months and months?
Yes.
If you justify it in the Mohicans case, then it seems that in any other kind of assisted suicide case, you would end up justifying it and that would be wrong. However, I don't believe there, I believe there are many cases, however, where someone will take a course of action under the principle of double effect. And while they foresee that they will die, it's not something that they intend. Yeah, they don't intend it. And so I say there, like in the case of the World Trade Center, we're not saying, you know, that these people are choosing death. They're just choosing, hopefully, another, you know, way to get out of a dangerous situation, knowing that they probably won't live. And of course, you can't make the greatest decision under circumstances.
Yeah, it's
like
hard
that.
To say they have the fullness of their presence of mind when a skyscraper is collapsing to the ground.
Sure. Or another example in war. Let's go back to movies. Go back to Captain America: First Avenger. Excellent movie that I would.
I have not seen.
Well, so there is a scene in the beginning where Captain America, Steve Rogers, before he becomes the super soldier, he goes to basic training and a test. They're trying to find the best soldier to turn into the super soldier for America. They don't want the biggest guy. They want the guy with the biggest heart. You know, the guy with the best virtue. So they see all these guys and they see this little guy, Steve Rogers, and they think, you know, what's this guy going to do? And so Tommy Lee Jones plays excellent lieutenant in the film. He takes what looks like a grenade and he says, "Grenade!" And he throws it and everyone scatters and Rogers jumps on it and tells everyone to get away. Now, suppose that were a real grenade.
Right.
You know, the soldier jumps on the grenade and saves his platoon buddies. Is it suicide? No.
Right.
Because his intent is not to die. If he were to somehow live, you'd say, "Oh, that's fine and dandy." I'd imagine a World War II vet would say something like that.
Right.
His intent is to save the lives of his fellow soldiers. He merely foresees he probably won't make it out of there alive. So it's these fine moral principles we have to take into account when we're talking about these issues that come up in sometimes complex situations.
Foresee but not intend. I'm sure that'll come up again in the course of the next 2 hours. 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. What Catholic teaching do you reject? Is it perhaps the church's teaching on contraception or divorce or monogamy? The church, in fact, says one wife, right? Maybe there's someone who rejects that teaching.
Jesus says you cannot serve more than one master.
See? I knew you'd have an explanation for it, Trent. 888-318-7884. Shall we try to get one call in before the break?
Maybe we should let it reset so we have time to unspool.
All right, very good. Well, then I will say this. How would you like to be able to answer questions about Catholic moral teaching the way Trent Horn does, or the way he's about to? The good news, you can, if you have the right tools. And one thing that Catholic Answers has put together here is our School of Apologetics. And Trent has an entire course called Moral Apologetics, covering a lot of the same territory we're going to cover in the next 2 hours, that will equip you to answer moral questions and defend the moral teachings of the Catholic Church. Here's what one student had to say. It's simply laid out and logical. It's a program that can be digested in small chunks. The regular use of examples helps one understand how Catholic moral teaching is applied in various situations. The best thing is I help myself remember by trying to explain to my kids what I have learned. Trent, you're helping a father be a father there.
Mm-hmm.
I like Trent Horn, very knowledgeable and presents information in an understandable way, just simply fantastic. So, great way to spend your summer building up your apologetic muscles. Visit schoolofapologetics.com today. Right back after this.
Catholic Answers Live with Trent Horn is coming right back.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit MysticMonkCoffee.com. That's MysticMonkCoffee.com.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
There's all kinds of prayers. There's all kinds of ways of praying. There's all kinds of methods of praying. There's a Salesian method, and Francis de Sales, and Ignatius of Loyola. There's Franciscan methods, and Dominican methods, and you name it, we got it. But sometimes we depend on a method too much. St. Teresa said that prayer was conversation with God. Do you have a hard time conversing with people? No, I don't have a hard time. Well, that's how it is with God.
Truth. Chris Check sitting in for Cy Kellett. The show is Catholic Answers Live. My guest, Trent Horn. The topic for the next 2 hours, which Catholic moral teaching do you reject? Trent, it looks like some members of the Supreme Court of the United States reject some Catholic moral teaching. In fact, probably more than one. But alas, recently we've learned now another blow against human life. This recently handed out decision concerning the case in Louisiana.
Yeah, there was the case that was brought to the Supreme Court dealt with a Louisiana law that was almost identical to a Texas law that came before the court recently, about 4 years ago. And this law dealt with whether abortion facilities could be required to have doctors have hospital admitting privileges to a nearby hospital within a 30-mile radius, which is something that is usually required for any kind of outpatient surgery facility. So in 2016, the court struck down. What's interesting about this case is that in the case that was recently just decided, it was a 5-4 decision where the court was split on this that struck down Louisiana's law requiring admitting privileges, saying that it would create an undue burden on women seeking an abortion. This goes back to the Planned Parenthood versus Casey case of 1992 that really didn't change abortion legislation per se, but gave this principle. So it scrapped Roe's trimester system and said, look, the state can legislate abortion as long as it doesn't put an undue burden on a woman's ability to have an abortion. So that's what they said in Casey, and that's been applied ever since. In 2016, in the Texas ruling, the court said requiring hospital admitting privileges could close a fair number of abortion facilities and take them out of women's reach, undue burden. Here's what's interesting, though, about the case, Chris, is in that case, Roberts was the split vote, the deciding vote here in the recent case, in the Louisiana case, and he sided with the liberal justices as if they were two distinct sets, which I'm starting to doubt more recently.
Right.
That he sided with them, saying that no, that this creates an undue burden. What's strange about it is that in 2016, Roberts dissented against the Texas ruling that that struck down the admitting privileges requirement. So in 2016, he sided with saying that the requirement was not burdensome. But now in 2020, Roberts says that it is burdensome. And so it seems like the only reason he is doing that is because what he put forward as his reasoning was a legal principle called stare decisis. I think the full term is stare decisis et quietum non movere, which means essentially do not disturb that which is decided. So the court has this principle basically that, look, when we decide a case, you're not supposed to just at the drop of a hat overturn it unless you have a really good reason for doing so.
How about that it was bad law to begin with?
Well, that's right. But that's what's odd is that if the principle of stare decisis is applied, which says you have to go with how you previously decided, it's Roberts is saying if you're going to apply it to him, then Roberts should just go with what he previously decided. So he said we shouldn't go against what we decided. Is the we If it's individually him, he should go with the same thing he did 4 years ago.
There's another element of the hypocrisy from the pro-death side here that is revealed, and that is that if abortion truly is about women's health care, then the advocates for abortion would want for doctors to have admitting privileges, because they would want the best doctors who had the admitting, who were regarded as good doctors by other hospitals and had these admitting privileges. And if something went wrong, then the woman's health could be protected in the course of the abortion. But in fact, that is not their chief concern.
Well, the fact of the matter is that they are trying to protect the bottom of the barrel who goes out into this industry. I'm sorry, when you've resorted to ending the lives of small human beings in
the world
for
money.
You're not a
doctor. Yeah.
No, you're not. You're as much a doctor as Joseph Mengele was a doctor,
right,
in the Nazi concentration camps.
Right.
So you are not the best. You're the bottom of the barrel. And they will bend over backwards to defend individuals involved in this and protect them from any hint of scandal whatsoever. And that is what we see here. That many complicit individuals, you look at Dr. Kermit Gosnell, for example,
yes,
in Pennsylvania.
This is a horror story.
The House of Horrors. He, probably America's most prolific serial killer, based on the number of born alive infants that he probably killed, which we still to this day don't know how many there were. And he was protected because at that time, it was in Pennsylvania, I believe. I think it was Ridge. I think it was Tom Ridge was the governor. Ridge or Wolf? I want to say Ridge.
Tom Ridge sounds right.
Yeah, Tom Ridge. He was the governor, and he's pro-choice. And the state moved to the only reason that Gosnell was brought down was not because of his health, the violations of his at his health clinic. It was violations against prescribing drugs illicitly.
Yes,
it's kind of like how they brought down Al Capone on tax evasion. And so, but that's what you see. And I've been there before, Chris. I've seen this on the local level of pro-life advocates who have tried to file complaints against abortion providers, for ambulances going in and out of their places routinely. And the local governments turn a blind eye if they are full of pro-choice politicians, which is why when you vote, even especially at the local level, it's important to vote for people who believe all people are people.
Yeah.
That should be a very simple statement. Who should I vote for? Start by voting for people. Only vote for people who think people are people.
Yes.
If they think some people are not people,
don't vote for them.
I don't trust them. Yeah. I don't see what's wrong with that as a principle.
It is a good one. Maybe someone will call and object to your voting principles, Trent. 888-318-7884. What Catholic moral teaching do you reject? Let's go to Sean in Fort Perry, Canada, listening on Alexa. Sean, welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, Chris. Hello, Trent. I need to say, Trent, that what I really respect about you, and I think a lot of people would agree with me, and the reason I'm asking you this question, and I'm kind of afraid to ask anybody else, mm-hmm. is I know you won't agree with what I'm about to say, but the way that you respond is so compassionate that people... feel when they're listening to you, I know that, okay, I disagree with what he just said, but I really respect him.
High praise. Thank you for that, Sean.
Well, thanks, Sean. So how can
I
help you?
It's the truth. What I find really disingenuous about the Catholic Church is its contradictory attitude toward gay people. Out of one side of its mouth, it says everybody should be respected and loved and so forth, and that includes gay people, but out of the other side of its mouth, it says they shouldn't have sex, and if they want to get married and have a committed relationship, they can't do that either. Mm-hmm. The Catholic Church will support the right of black people to be treated with equality and dignity, but sure, not gay people, and yet nobody chooses to be black. And nobody chooses to be gay, but there's that dichotomy, which to me is a genuine abuse of the whole idea of the essential equality of all people. And I mean, you've just been talking about aborting people, how disrespectful that is and how unjust that is. But one wonders if there was some kind of test to discern discern before somebody was born that they were going to be gay, would it be all right with the Catholic Church that they get aborted?
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, Sean, let's see if Trent mm-hmm. can't help us through this.
Sure, Sean. And first, I'll answer that last point, that it would be absolutely wrong to abort someone because they have a particular kind of sexual orientation. I remember, actually, I was in a debate once with Malcolm Potts, a well-known embryologist who defends legal abortion. And there was an awkward moment in the debate where they asked us about whether abortion was wrong in the case of Down syndrome. And I said it was absolutely wrong. And to argue for it in the presence of anyone who has Down syndrome would be a horribly offensive thing, I would imagine. And my opponent, Dr. Potts, tried to say, well, of course, people with Down syndrome are fully valuable and they're wonderful, you know, in the community. But at the same time, whom should I write to choose? Yeah, but it came off quite disingenuous there. So I see where you're coming from. So let's look at the terms that are involved. It sounds like you're saying that we have people who have a particular kind of sexual orientation or desire, and we ought to treat them with justice and not discriminate against them. So I full-heartedly agree with that, and the Catholic Church does agree with that. Where I think we're going to disagree is probably about when it comes to the issue of sexual morality, like what we do sexually matters. So to find common ground, for example, there was a case in Washington, D.C., about 30 years ago during the AIDS crisis. And there was a Catholic convent that had opened up that was providing hospice care for men who were dying of AIDS. And I think this is actually, they might have been the Sisters of Charity, actually, Mother Teresa's nuns. And there were people in the community who were protesting this, because especially back then, people didn't know how you could transmit AIDS, how transmittable was it, is this bad for the community? And the church and the nuns stood fast and said that every person deserves to be treated with dignity and respect. So denying someone medical care to treat them of a disease just because they have a certain sexual orientation, saying that it's okay to end their life or to kill them or commit violence against them, these are all very wrong. Even if you took someone who had this is their sexual orientation, it were discovered, that shouldn't matter what how you feel. That shouldn't matter what your attractions are. That's a subjective part of ourselves. But Sean, I think where we might disagree, though, is in the realm of sexual behavior. Because I think that who we choose to have sex with or what we choose to do with our sexual parts is morally relevant in a way that skin color is not. What do you think of that as a basic principle, that who we choose to have sex with or what we choose to do sexually can have very grave moral implications?
Well, the part that I don't understand is heterosexual people can get married and have sex. Mm-hmm. Gay people are supposed to, all, every single one of them, mm-hmm. are supposed to be celibate, mm-hmm. period. They can't get married, they can't have sex. That's not even realistic.
Sure. Well, Sean, let me parse this correctly. They are free to marry if by marriage you mean engage in a lifelong union with a person of the opposite sex, though that may not be recommended for someone who has a deep-seated same-sex attraction. I think where it'll be difficult here is that the words sex and marriage, when you and I use them, might have very different meanings involved in them. And I think sometimes when people have these conversations about why doesn't the church let gay people do X, it's because the words sex and marriage, they get used in different ways. So for me, the word sex, what that refers to is the life-giving union that can only exist between a man and a woman. That's what the sexual act is. It becomes difficult to distinguish certain kinds of sexual behavior from the sexual act. For example, distinguishing the sexual act from what other people would call mutual masturbation, for example. Or take marriage. So let's take that we're defining what marriage is. I would hold that marriage is a very specific definition. Marriage is the lifelong union of one man and one woman. How would you define those terms? You see how you might define them differently and be hard for us to find common ground on them?
Well, I think so, because I believe that it's possible for two people of the same gender to have a loving, committed, monogamous relationship. And the Catholic Church does say that expression of the sexual act between two married people, in a loving way, in a way that each one is fully giving to the other one, is as important to the marriage as the procreation of children. And even St. Paul says about marriage, it's better to marry than to burn. But again, the Catholic Church denies that opportunity to two people of the same gender who love each other, want to live together in a committed relationship.
Well, what I would say, Sean, is that two people are free to live together if they're of the same gender. People can love one another and be committed to care for one another. There's nothing that preventing saying that a person should not engage in sexually arousing behavior with another person. That doesn't preclude two people of the same gender from forming a household. Brothers and sisters and mothers and daughters sometimes do that. I think, though, it's going to come back to this fundamental question. What is sex for? To me, that's the question that has to be answered. If it's just put in an extremely broad way, like sex is just a something that is a pleasurable activity we engage in with others for emotional or physical comfort, that could lead to a wide range of activities that we find to be very bad. I'll put a bow on this when we come back, but I'm very grateful that you called in.
Thank you very much, Sean. 888-318-7884. Catholic Answers Live, right back after this.
Hang on, we'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Who and what were the major figures and ideas of the Protestant Reformation? Is it true that the medieval Catholic Church was so corrupt that a total religious revolution was necessary? How did the Church respond to the Reformation? And what were its lasting effects on Christianity and world history? In 20 Answers, the Reformation, you'll find smart, solid answers to these questions and many more in a perfect introduction to the major players, concepts, and events of this defining period in Western history. 20 Answers, the Reformation is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting series from Catholic Answers Press.
Many Catholics ignore the Bible. They say they have the Church instead. But we should embrace sacred scripture, not just as the revealed Word of God, but as a Catholic work, intimately connected with the Church from the earliest centuries. In The Bible is a Catholic Book, apologist Jimmy Akin shows how the Bible cannot exist apart from the Church, in its origins, in the truths it contains, in its careful preservation. Over the centuries, Scripture is inseparable from the Catholic faith. This is fitting, since both come from God for our salvation. If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the Church. After all, Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 1-844-239-4952. Visiting shop.catholic.com or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Truth, Catholic Answers Live. I am Chris Check, president of Catholic Answers, sitting in for Cy Kellett, my guest, Trent Horn. Trent, before the break, you were explaining to our friend Sean in Canada the Church's teaching with respect to people with same-sex attraction acting on their inclinations. Before I give it back to Trent, Sean, I know we lost you, but I do encourage you to visit CourageRC.net and on that website and through the Courage Apostolate. I think you're going to find a lot of good resources that can be helpful to you as you try to unpack what the Church's teaching is on this question. Trent.
Yeah, and what I wanted to do to put tie all that together is that the disagreement that Sean and many people have with the Church's teaching on homosexuality and on same-sex marriage goes back to fundamental questions, namely, what is sex for and what is marriage, or what is marriage for? That's the question we have to answer. So I find it interesting that Sean's view is similar to many other people in that sex is permissible if it's between two people who are loving and committed to one another. But then I would ask, well, why should I believe that? The most basic level of morality when it comes to sex in our culture seems to be two people who consent, or at least two people who consent. And you'll find different perspectives. Some people say that love and commitment are important, but I would say, well, why? Why is that a necessary condition for sex to be moral? When is sex moral? When does it become immoral? If you define it very broadly, that sex is just a way for people to express love and affection for other people, well, then why wouldn't broader sexual relations, things that we call adultery, it's like you're only allowed to have one spouse? Well, not like somebody says you can only have one friend.
Right.
You know, that'd be possessive. You can only have one person. You either polyamory, which would be officiated adultery, you know, with other people, or adultery, you know, or serial adultery, which would be divorce, remarriage.
If it's an expression of friendship and love, why keep it exclusive?
Why worry about the marriage element, fornication, prostitution, pornography, polyamory? And then we have paraphilias. Paraphilias would be sexual disorders. And you can go to Wikipedia if you're have a strong stomach. I appreciate that at least there's no bad pictures or anything like that, at least not that I'm aware of at this time. And you can scroll through a list of paraphilias, which would be sexual disorders, people being attracted to all sorts of things except for the proper end of the sexual act. And there are doozies on that list. I've tried to think of examples, Chris, when we dialogue about this issue, it's very important not to bring up examples that are landmines.
Right.
So when people say, you know, what about homosexuality? Is it a proper ordered desire? If you say, well, do you think pedophilia is a proper ordered desire?
Right.
And of course it's not. The other person's just going to hear you say you think people who have homosexual inclinations are pedophiles, which is not what you said.
Right.
But that's what they're going to hear. So I try to pick paraphilia is to say, is it obvious here that this is a sexual disorder? If you are sexually attracted to inanimate objects, trees, dinosaurs, that is one.
Yep.
Unfortunately, Chris, if you can think of it, there probably is a section of the internet dedicated to that particular paraphilia. Even many other people listening will say, well, that is disordered. Well, why? If sex is just about having, well-being and good feelings in yourself expressed towards other people or things, what does it matter? Only understanding...
Now, Sean would argue here, but no, I was saying a committed relationship.
Right, and I would ask why. Why is it? When we say, like, committed relationship, normally what we mean by that is you agree not to have sex with other people.
Right.
It's a euphemism for saying I won't cheat on you.
Yes.
When we say the committed part. But why does that matter? And once again, it would be... put controlling if you said, you know, you can only have one friend. I can have as many friends as I want. Yet we see sex as something restricted to only one person. We understand that monogamous element, but that it only takes two to tango. That only makes sense if sex is ordered towards uniting only two people towards a good beyond themselves.
Yes.
And that good would be the good of procreation. It's not always achieved. Much the same way as when you go and play baseball, you don't always hit a home run.
Nope.
But it's ordered towards that end. And so it's ordered towards that particular end for men and women. That's when it's ordered. And it becomes disordered when it's moved away from that. So I would say for Sean and others listening, I would say among Christians, the Catholic Church, and I've actually read atheists and other secular critics who give the Catholic... Oh, when I had my dialogue with Brandon Robertson here in the studio, he is a pro-LGBT Protestant pastor. He said in the dialogue, he actually appreciated the Catholic view on sexuality. Because he said, I talked to my other Protestant pastors who... believe homosexual behavior is a sin. And he tells them, you guys don't see anything wrong with contraception. You don't see anything wrong with divorce. Why do you see something wrong with homosexuality? And he said, I give the Catholics credit that at least they're consistent in everything.
Yes.
So I said, well, give it some thought and come back to 2020 Gillespie at some point.
888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. Let's go to Jonathan in Jackson, Florida. Jonathan, welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hey, Trent. Hey, President Chris. Thank you all for having
for sure.
me.
We need to play Hail to the Chief, and anyone calls him that.
That's quite all right.
Not to beat a dead horse, but
sure.
my question was actually had this interaction with somebody on Reddit well, actually multiple people, because anybody can comment.
Sure.
And I was trying to break down, Mother Teresa would say, beloved children of God with homosexual tendencies. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's a Matt Frad edition.
I'm sure Mother Teresa said it. She said everything.
That's right.
So go right ahead.
Right. I'm trying to nail down natural law, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to say, okay, you know, the speech is to tell the truth. Ears are to hear. Sexual organs are for reproduction, things like that. But none of those examples really hit. They basically said, like, by what authority are you telling me, and you said earlier, who, mm-hmm. what, or where, how we use our sexuality is morally relevant. So
right.
How is that morally relevant, and how does the church give us the moral authority, be it natural law or whatever it is, to say definitively that intrinsically...
Trent, where do you go with someone who says, I reject your teaching on natural law? I don't believe there is such a thing.
Well, there's several routes that you could go. One you could say is that the teaching on sexual ethics is not restricted to natural law. Sean and I had a discussion where I appealed to natural law principles or secular reasoning, which I think in this day and age is important. But I also think it's fine to say, what does God think about this? Like, we've lost sense of that a little bit. To say, why don't we see what has God told us about the proper use of our sexuality? It's kind of funny, Chris, that there are people who will defend kind of more liberal Christians who will defend pro-LGBT sexual behavior and then write off the Bible. And yet they'll run to the Bible to defend things like we were talking about at the beginning of the show, paying laborers what they're worth, being good stewards of the environment, justice and compassion towards immigrants. And they'll quote Bible verse after Bible verse to support something that they believe in,
sure. But
then shy away from Paul talking about how same-sex sexual behavior is disordered in Romans chapter 1 or 1 Corinthians chapter 6. So I'd say first, what has God told us sexuality is for? So you could even say, well, we can move from natural law just to divine revelation. Or you can go back to natural law and you can make a defense of natural law, Jonathan. You could say, look, sometimes I think what's helpful here is just to start with very basic intuitions to say, are there some things that are always right and some things that are always wrong that oblige us to act in those ways? And to ask these people, what are you talking about here? What are we talking about with these things? So we agree that there are moral principles that exist. Like you could say, here's a universal good. Love your neighbor as yourself. Do good. Avoid evil. It seems clear these are obligations we have that are universal among human beings. And then there's some things that we ought never do, like do not torture a child for fun. Do not engage in the act of rape. Don't do evil that good may come from it. So I think, Jonathan, you could start with there saying, look, here are just very basic universal moral truths. We could call that natural law. So these truths exist. And what Thomas Aquinas says is that natural law is the rational creature's participation in the eternal law of God. So we know these truths exist. The next question becomes, how do we discover them? Are there different clues to that? Well, when we look at human, you could say, what by what authority? Well, when you look at human beings, you know there are things about us that show we ought to behave in a certain way. Because we're capable of being rational, for example, we have a duty to be rational. So that's one example that you can bring. You can say, well, why can't I I'm on a dinosaur kick with my kids. Every morning, Matthew gets my bed. He says, can I watch another 10 facts video on dinosaurs? So on Council of Trent, we're going to do a dinosaur episode soon. But I know everything about Spinosaurus, Dinosuchus, all of them. But they'll go around and just, you know, rip other dinosaurs' heads off if that's what they think will make their day better. Why can't I do that? Why am I held to a different standard than the dinosaurs or the lions at the zoo?
Hardly seems fair, Trent.
Yeah. Why not? Well, most people will say is things something like this. You can choose X or Y. And I'm guessing what they mean by choose is the good. So now we look at, because I have this rational capacity, I'm obliged to use it. That's interesting. So then we can start looking at our other aspects of our behavior. Jonathan, another analogy I like to use when it comes to bodily functions and moral use might be eating. That eating is ordered when we take in food to receive its nutrients. It's disordered when we take in food only for taste and then vomit up the nutrients later. And that's something similar that you can apply to sexuality, only seeking the pleasure rather than the goods associated with it. So that's a few examples there. I'd also recommend a book by Jay Budachevsky. He has a book called What We Can't Not Know. So it's a book on natural law itself. Let me make sure that I got the title right here.
That sounds right.
What We Can't Not Know. What We Can't Not Know, a guide by Jay Budachevsky, Jay Bud, known to his friends. I threw a lot out there at you, but is that at least a helpful start?
Yeah, it's great. I'm looking up that book right now. It's exactly what I needed because I think I was trying to reach out to the nuns that are just in this relative dictatorship of relativism, if you will. And I couldn't really hammer it down with examples. I was trying to get to something very succinct, and I couldn't.
We're very grateful for your call, Jonathan. I especially appreciate, Trent, that eating analogy, because it goes to it seems to me it goes to the heart of the matter that we all do, in fact, have a nature.
Yes.
We have a nature, and it is self-evident to us. Now, it's possible there are elements of our nature that are not immediately self-evident that Revelation has helped us with. I'm not even sure if that's true or not. But someone who is, I think, going to be honest with himself will say, yeah, I do have a nature. And when I do things that are contrary to that nature,
it's bad for me.
Yeah, it's bad for me. And that can be
I think what happens, Chris, before we go to the break here, is that people can see this in non-sexual elements easily. They see eating disorders for what they are. They see body identity disorders for what
they
are.
Or dragging, cutting yourself with a razor blade or...
Right, mutilation, self-destruction, right. Pica, which is a disorder where someone wants... There's actually a recent film that came out a year or two ago. I think it's called Swallow. It's not for the faint of heart. And it's a fictional account, but it's a real disorder of people who swallow glass, thumbtacks, and they have this desire to want to swallow inedible things that are not what they're meant to be eating. But I think when it comes to sex, what happens is people will throw common sense absolutely out the window. When it comes to other subjects, like obviously someone who is white is not black or African American, no matter what they say. And people will say it's racist for you to identify in that way. The Rachel Dolezal case a few years ago. But if a man identifies as a woman, well, I have to respect that, I guess. Why is it with sex? Is common sense always thrown out the window? I believe this happens because people are afraid that their proclivities, that if they condemned, people with sexual desires, run of the mill on the standard median, if they were to say that transgender identity is disordered, or certain kinds of paraphilia, certain kinds of sexual disorders are disordered. If they were to put down a fence and say, oh, you can't do that, logical implications would move the fence closer and closer to them.
Yes.
And it would start to encroach on the things that they look at on the internet, on the things that the sexual behaviors that they do in private. And so there is a deep concern, I think, in our culture of people who are not directly engaging in the more radical sexual behaviors, but they're hesitant to want to condemn those behaviors because they're worried the judgment will come back on the things that they do in secret.
And it's also clear that socially we continue to push the envelope.
Yeah, you push further. It's very hard to go backwards.
Amen. Amen.
Unless there's a dramatic, catastrophic decline of civilization.
Which, by the way, the Book of Revelation may be one of the most misunderstood books in the Bible. Let Jimmy Akin break it down for you in his new MP3, Understanding Revelation. Guess what, my friends? This MP3 is free. Go to shop.catholic.com right now and click on the banner at the bottom of the page to download our new free MP3, Understanding Revelation. That's shop.catholic.com, right back after this.
Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Next time on EWTN Live. Tufik Bellini shares how the nonprofit In Defense of Christians advocates for religious freedom and protection in the Middle East on the next EWTN Live.
EWTN Live with me, Father Mitch Packwell, Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern on EWTN TV and radio.
Truth. Trent, we're behind in calls here.
But we got time.
We do.
We have time, indeed.
We have 2 hours, praise God, or an hour.
Hour and 15 minutes left.
Alex in Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Alex, I don't know if you are aware of this, but you and all of the Nebraska Catholics, all the Nebraska faithful, are truly blessed with Spirit Catholic Radio. That is a first-rate Catholic radio network. Jim Carroll, who runs that network, is just the greatest guy, and we love our friendship with Spirit Catholic Radio. What is your question for Trent Horn?
Hi, guys.
Hi.
So we are blessed with the Spirit Catholic Radio out here. It's awesome to listen to you guys every day. So my question, I was posed the question, what is the difference between NFP and contraception, and the fact that with contraception you're saying, I don't want to have a baby. With NFP, you're tracking, you know, the times when you do want to have sex, when you don't, so that way, in case you don't want to get pregnant. Mm-hmm. And say, well, what's the difference between that? Because both ways, you don't want to get pregnant.
Yeah, Trent, this goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the hour. I mean, if I'm practicing NFP, I'm intending not to have a baby. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. So help unpack this.
Yeah, so this is a question that comes up often. What is the difference between natural family planning and contraception? It also comes up in this as an argument that if contraception is a way to not have a baby, quote unquote, then natural family planning is a kind of contraception. So there's no meaningful difference between the two. A few different ways I would respond to this. First, a short bullet point would be this. NFP is information. Contraception is sterilization. That is the first key difference between the two. We'd ask, what is natural family planning? Natural family planning, in principle, is just information that you have about your spouse. It's information. And information, you know, knowledge is power, as the PSA says. Information is not a bad thing if you have a right to that information, which we do have a right to know how our bodies work. So there's nothing wrong with having information and knowing if I engage in sexual relations on this day, there is a likelihood of conception. If I engage in it on this day, there is a lower likelihood. So it's information. Contraception, however, is not information. So it's information. And then from that information, you have two activities, neither of which can possibly be construed as contraception. From that information, you either have sexual relations where you fully and freely give yourself to one another without any barriers or chemicals between the spouses. So full, free, complete gift of self and sexual union and abstinence and any other recreational activity that would take place of sex within that abstaining period. So NFP can't be contraception because it's just full, free gift of self and sexual union without any barriers whatsoever, which hardly anyone would look at that activity and say the couple's engaging in contraception when there's no contraceptives to be had, or abstinence. And most people in our culture will say that abstinence is not the same thing as contraception. So they're very different in that regard. Contraception, however, is not information. It is sterilization. It is taking the sexual act and actively intervening into it to alter it, to prevent the husband and wife from fully and completely giving themselves to one another. So that's one way I make the distinction. There's another analogy. I talk about this in my course, Evidence for Catholic Moral Teaching. And Alex, this is an analogy that I use to talk about NFP and contraception. It's predated me. Lots of other speakers have used it. It's called the wedding invitation analogy. And it goes like this. Suppose a couple, I've altered it a bit, actually. I think it works better this way. Suppose a couple is trying to pick a date for their wedding. In fact, we have some people here at the office who are trying to pick a date for their wedding to invite people. And under COVID restrictions, it's difficult to fit everyone in. So imagine a couple, engaged couple, is trying to pick a date for their wedding. All right. So they could pick a day where they know that all of their cousins will be able to arrive. They pick a day and send out invitations. They know, hey, the cousins are all free. We've got, my family has 60 of them, and we know they're free that Saturday. I'm going to send invitations, pick that day, and a lot of the cousins are going to show up, and that's great. But so that would be analogous to natural family planning and using it to engage in relations on a day where you're likely to conceive. You pick the day, likely for kids to show up. Suppose the couple said, however, we're going to schedule our wedding, but we actually can't have that many tables, COVID restrictions and all that. What are we going to do? So let's pick this day and we'll send out invitations. But you know what? I know that my cousins have a football tournament that Saturday, so odds are they're not going to be able to come. They're wanted, but we know they probably aren't going to show up. If they do, it might be a bit stressful. It's a surprise that they're there, but we will manage and welcome them lovingly. That would be analogous if they pick the day and send the invitations when the cousins are unlikely to show up. That's using NFP to choose sexual relations on a low fertility day. Now, suppose the couple said, well, we really want that other Saturday, but we also don't want the cousins there. So we're going to pick our ideal Saturday and we're going to send letters to the cousins saying, don't show up. We don't want you here. We're going to send them a disinvitation. You are not wanted. Don't even think of showing up. If you show up, we might have you killed later. Really don't want them there. That would be analogous to using contraceptives to engage in sexual relations on one's own terms, but communicating the message to the future life that may be conceived, it is unwanted. And if it does break through, it may meet a fatal end later. So I talk about that at more at length in my course and also in my book, co-written with Layla Miller on Made This Way, which if you stay on the line, I'm happy to send you a copy. I threw a lot out at you there. I'll send you the book for you to read and review what I went over. Is that at least a good start?
I think that's great. Another side question.
Sure.
So it's kind of what I said also, but then they said, well, how's that being open to life when you only will have relations on the days that you know that you're not going to be fertile?
And so, Alex, what I would say here is earlier I said that NFP is in principle information. Using this information, having this information, it's not sinful. Like, it's not sinful to know when your partner is fertile or infertile. However, natural family planning can be abused.
Yes.
It can be abused so that it is used exclusively to prevent children from being conceived under circumstances when they should be welcomed. What the church teaches is that a couple may use natural family planning to space the births of their children. In fact, they ought to space the births of their children, but they should do that. And they may use natural family planning if they have a just reason for doing so. They have to have a just reason. So if it is a reason that conforms to the good of their family, like let's say they don't feel financially prepared to receive a child, maybe they just lost their health insurance and they're concerned about affording birth, they just have to have a just reason for using this, because God gave us all married couples, all different kinds of days throughout the years to engage in the sexual act. This information can be abused, just as information about our neighbor's faults. We may have that information. It's not a sin to have that information if we acquired it in a sinless way, but we could use that information to do something sinful with it. Much the same with natural family planning. You could use that information to sinfully abstain from sexual acts that are likely to conceive. So one ought to be open to life. But here's the thing. With natural family planning, it's not 100%. Even if you engage on a low fertility day, it is still possible to conceive a child. What God asks of us is simply this: to be open to life, is to fully and freely, when a husband and wife engage in the marital act, to fully give themselves to one another whenever they do so. That's all God asks from us. And so when we do that, there are days he's given us where that's likely to result in the conception of a child. There are days where it's not likely. So to be open to life just means fully giving oneself in those acts. But one could be not open to life if you use NFP in a calculated long-term way to oppose conceiving a child for reasons that are not just. So I hope that's helpful, and I'd recommend the book Made This Way. We'll be sure to send you a copy of that.
Alex, we'll also send you a copy of Inseparable. So we celebrated 2 years ago in 2018 the 50th anniversary of Humanae Vitae, Paul VI encyclical, addressing the question of artificial contraception. I think it's the best book we came out with in 2018. I'm actually not sure, Trent, if any of your books came out that year, so forgive me. Anyway.
Something was around that time.
But nonetheless, forward by Cardinal Burke. It's called Inseparable, shop.catholic.com. Folks, Catholics, non-Catholics, if you're trying to get your imagination, your understanding around this question, and Trent has done a good job, but it is an involved question and one that confounds a lot of folks. So get a copy of Inseparable, shop.catholic.com. 888-318-7884. We're going to take a 5 minute, six. Nick Chamberlain, what is it? I can never remember. 5 minute break, and we will be back with the second hour and Trent Horn. Catholic Answers Live.